Firefighters are jumping on new wildfires in the Flathead National Forest. That's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates Carney. A Montana researcher isn't worried about Ebola breaking out in the United States. And Yellowstone Public Radio's Jackie Yamanaka continues her series on the challenges veterans face in receiving health care.
Four different wildfires were sparked in the Flathead National Forest today after dry thunderstorms passed over the area. A hotshot crew is on their way to the Akanoka Peak Fire in the North Fork near Whale Creek, which is estimated to be at about 3 to 5 acres. Meanwhile, engines from the Tally Lake Ranger District and the Department of Natural Resource Conservation are battling a fire north of Whitefish Lake. Public Affairs Officer for the Flathead Forest, Wade Muehlhoff, says it's important for state and federal agencies to look beyond their boundaries when fighting wildland fires.
Whenever we get fires, they really don't know any of these boundaries. So that's truly how we try and approach it. Fire managers from both the national agencies and then the local agencies all year are planning and working together, doing training together, because come fire season, we need each other's help. And today's a great example of that, where it doesn't really matter what boundary it's in. Everybody pulls together to help fight these wildfires.
Muehlhoff says a third fire north of the Ford cabin was quickly put out by crews from Glacier National Park, and another fire was spotted near Trail Creek in the southern region of the Bob Marshall Wilderness. Officials are surveying that fire by air to gather more information. The Kalispell Interagency Dispatch Center estimates that there were over 130 lightning strikes in the region last night.
The rugged terrain and steep ridges of the Lost Horse Wildfire in the Bitterroot Mountains are forcing fire crews to rely heavily on helicopters instead of attacking it on foot. Lightning strikes started the 59-acre fire on Friday afternoon near Brandy Peak, about 10 miles southeast of Hamilton. Public Affairs Officer Todd McKay says helicopters dropped almost 73,000 gallons of water on burning trees and hotspots on Saturday alone, along with 4,000 gallons of flame retardant from an aerial tanker.
Rock cliffs, it's rock outcroppings, it's huge boulder fields with rocks the size of vehicles, and so even if we could get firefighters in there, which we have looked at multiple ways trying to hike in, but the nearest road or trail is about 3 miles from where the fire is burning and it's straight up. We've looked at repelling folks in from helicopters, but the question that that they ask is, once we get on the ground, what are we supposed to do? Because they can't build fire line in such rocky terrains.
McKay says ground crews have been clearing debris from the trail systems on Camas Lake and the Como area in case the fire spreads east. All the aerial firefighting efforts have been expensive so far, with a $200,000 price tag.
You know, anytime you use helicopters and air tankers, it's not cheap to try to fight wildland fire. And so, unfortunately, where we're at now, really that's the only effective way to try to control this, and the last thing we want is that fire coming out of the canyon, hitting some of the heavy timber and pushing to the east where we have structures and homes and our community. So we're going to do everything that we can, and right now the best, most effective means to fight this fire is with the air resources, and so that's what we're doing.
Minimal wind and cloud cover have helped keep the fire in check today, but officials have restricted overnight camping in the Lost Horse Corridor.
There's only one way in and one way out of that corridor, and so we have posted a road guard there to let folks know about the fire activity, and we want to let the community know that that's for public safety, and just so we can keep tabs in case the situation changes, we know exactly who's in there, and we can go in and get them the latest information.
We'll have more weather information later in the broadcast.
In other news from around Montana, the U.S. Army War College will have the final say over whether any punishment is warranted in a plagiarism investigation against Senator John Walsh. Spokesman Carol Kerr said today that the Department of Defense and U.S. Army Inspectors General will be notified before the release of the findings, but the authority to take disciplinary action remains with the War College. Provost Lance Betros previously said the Defense Department had asserted jurisdiction over the investigation because it involved a member of Congress, and the department would decide any sanctions. The college asked for and received clarification about that jurisdiction after an Associated Press story reporting Betros' comments. A New York Times story showed Walsh used others' work without attribution in a 2007 research paper. The school's investigation will begin on August 15th.
Republican congressional candidate Ryan Zinke says Montana's energy resources should be developed to ensure the nation has energy independence.
Any energy plan that doesn't include coal, oil, and gas is really the energy plan that's tantamount to, you know, pixie dust and hope. And it doesn't take in consideration Montana's assets.
Zinke is also calling for streamlined permitting of projects and temporarily halting federal Environmental Protection Agency regulations. He released his energy plan today in Billings. He categorized it as an all-of-the-above energy strategy that also includes solar, wind, hydro, and nuclear power generation.
My opponent's plan doesn't mention oil, coal, or gas. I don't know how you could have an energy plan that doesn't. It also supports, you know, continuing subsidies on wind and solar.
Zinke says he doesn't believe the government should decide energy winners and losers. In response, a spokeswoman for Democratic congressional candidate John Lewis says the campaign is pleased Zinke is using some of Lewis's ideas on energy. But Kathy Weber said in an email statement that, quote, Zinke's plan is laced with partisan rhetoric and does nothing to solve problems or bring people together toward solutions, unquote. Weber says Zinke is wrong because Lewis doesn't call for subsidies for wind and solar energy.
An important part of the global effort to develop a vaccine for the deadly Ebola virus is taking place at Rocky Mountain Laboratories in western Montana's Bitterroot Valley. A specific strain of Ebola has so far killed over 670 people in West Africa. Death by Ebola is a terrible fate that starts with unremarkable symptoms: fever, sore throat, chills, and muscle aches. If left undiagnosed and untreated, however, it can eventually progress to rampant bleeding, diarrhea, mental confusion, multiple organ failure, and then a shock syndrome, which usually leads to death. The Ebola outbreak unfolding in Africa is described as the largest in history and is raising concerns about international travel and global pandemic. Dr. Heinz Feldman is chief of the Laboratory of Virology at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory's National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Diseases in Hamilton. Feldman says the medical community must always be cautious and prepared to deal with serious illnesses, but he adds there's no need to worry about someone infected with Ebola entering our country.
Our healthcare system is so sophisticated in these basic rules that we are much better off than any of these hospitals in developing countries. So if a patient would come with an unknown illness, particularly if it's an infectious or if the cause is most likely infectious, there won't be any nurse in this country that is not going to put gloves on and that is not going to put some protection on, because we have it available, we are set up, we have protocols, they have to follow protocols. And these basic measurements will prevent an outbreak.
Edward O'Brien will have more with Dr. Feldman on the Ebola virus later this week on Montana Evening Edition.
Leaders of the Little Shell tribe of Chippewa Indians says that the time has come to remove words half-breed and breed from the names of creeks, lakes, and other places around the state. Nicholas Vrooman, who works with the tribe, presented a bill draft that affected would during a recent meeting with the State Tribal Relations Committee. He says the words are racist terms that demean American Indians. The bill would require state and other agencies to identify places with the terms and remove them from maps and signs when age or vandalism calls for an update. It would also create an advisory group to determine replacement names. Vrooman says 17 places in Montana have the word half-breed or breed in them, including Half-Breed Lake National Wildlife Refuge.
As political and military leaders are winding down the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, thousands of service members are returning home. Many need services, whether they be medical care, help finding a job, or housing. And they're coming home to a political climate of fiscal austerity. As part of an ongoing series, Jackie Yamanaka is gathering individual stories from veterans about that and the challenges they face in getting the care they need.
My name is Mark Vomond. I've been in the military for the last 26 years. I joined the Army because I've always wanted to serve in the military. You know, some kids want to be a firefighter, some kids want to do this or that, and I always wanted to serve in the military.
So after high school, Vomond enlisted in the Army National Guard, eventually working up to a Special Forces unit. In 2000, he decided to go active duty.
Unfortunately, we had 9/11 shortly thereafter. And that kind of changed everything that we expected to happen. Because I don't believe anyone thinks combat is a good thing. And I had roughly 10 years of combat.
During that time, Vomond had numerous combat injuries. The retired Green Beret has been awarded 5 Bronze Star medals and 2 Purple Heart medals. He says his military career was everything he expected it to be, and he thrived in his special operations unit in Afghanistan and Iraq. So he thought after he was injured by a roadside bomb in March 2010, he would fully heal within 3 to 6 months and go back into combat, just as he had in the past. Only later did he come to realize this time was different.
My breaking point was that large blast that cracked my skull. And I didn't come home the same way. And it took about a year to actually realize how bad it was.
Bowman says, among other things, he couldn't sleep, had night terrors and night sweats. Still, he didn't want to consider that he might have post-traumatic stress disorder.
I thought PTSD didn't exist. I thought it was an out, you know. And many people in special operations feel the same way. PTSD is a weakness. So you don't have weaknesses when you lay it all on the line.
But he says 3 years later, he saw how his anger and emotional shutdown was affecting his family.
As I improve, I get more emotion. And before, I have a stone face. I had no emotion. My kid got his foot run over by a car. I didn't care. So the car ran over. We need to go to the hospital. It was cut and dry. It was stone. And my family felt it, and that's brutal on a family. I had built these walls inside myself that so easily could just... I cared about Herco, but I did not care about... And this is ugly. And I'm not the only one. I had no physical tie to my family. Emotionally, I could not go there. But now I am, thanks to all the support I've had.
Herco is Voman's military working dog. He was also injured in that IED blast and also given a military retirement. Today, Herco is Voman's service dog and constant companion. Bowman smiles constantly and easily today. He says he looks forward to being with his family and playing with his kids. He credits this to 6 weeks of hyperbaric oxygen therapy. He says it restored his field of vision, got him off of heavy medication, and he can now sleep through the night.
Shortly thereafter, I had my first good dream. Significant events when you have nothing but darkness. So that's the glimmer of hope. So that will reduce our veteran suicide, which is probably something that everyone talks about, but there's no answers.
The problem is, he says, veterans health insurance, TRICARE, doesn't currently recognize the use of hyperbaric therapy for the treatment of traumatic brain injury, or TBI. And that was confirmed by a spokesman at the Defense Health Agency, which manages the military health system TRICARE. The nonprofit Green Beret Foundation paid Voman's hyperbaric treatment bill that totaled about $7,000. Still, Voman doesn't blame the VA.
It goes to the top. We as a country need to support the veterans coming home with the injuries of war, whatever they might be, and that is a huge task. And it's money, it's people. It's programs.
He says he's talked to several politicians and others, but has had very little success.
I mean, everyone wants to help. Everyone says that's a great idea. But bureaucracy is bureaucracy, and it is a complicating thing.
Bowman's hope is by telling his story, he can raise public awareness, spur public action, and provide hope to other veterans. Jackie Yamanaka, YPR News.
In the forecast, there is a chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms across our listening area this evening, with lows expected in the 50s. Tomorrow, we'll see partly cloudy skies with a further chance of rain and thunder and highs in the upper 80s to mid-90s. And now for the editorial comments of Patricia Rosenleaf.
who fought in Vietnam had an expression. There's no use talking about Vietnam, because if you weren't there, you could never understand. And if you were there, there's no need to talk about it. When I heard that said recently, the thought struck me that what was being said about Vietnam could also be said about losing one's life partner. Only those who have suffered the loss can come close to understanding. Robert Frost, narrator in Home Burial, says, "The nearest friends can go with anyone to death come so far short, they might as well not try to go at all." Living after such a loss is like a trip to a foreign country from which you will never return. Odd as it seems, it's as if one has wandered into this country with no foreplanning, no knowledge of the geography, the morals, the customs, and yet everyone and everything there is familiar, and the expectation is that you will just make your way. One's memory is vastly affected, too. I had an acute recall of the time directly following Carl's passing. I remember precisely who did and did not come to his services. But there are giant whiteout times when I recall nothing of the days and weeks which followed. Just a year later, I had to ask my sister-in-law whether I'd gone to the family reunion that September, some 2.5 months after Carl died. I still have no recall of most of that summer, although I know I went back to our remote cabin by myself, only because I wrote about it in the cabin diary. Another aspect of what I call the rotten onion of awful realization, ROAR for short, is the tectonic slipping of friendships. Friends with whom we'd enjoyed the closest of times slipped through my fingers like fish in a pond. I was no longer the entity that we had been. I was half now, and being with them caused me anguish beyond telling because Carl wasn't there and should have been. Frost's narrator says it this way, "Friends make pretense of following to the grave, but before one is in it, their minds are turned and making the best of their way back to life and living people and things they understand. And that is how it should be. One cannot expect others, no matter how close, to accompany one down that road into the foreign country. Bless the family and friends who try, though. I had a dear friend who called me every day for a year, another who sent me a heartfelt card at least once a month to let me know that I was in her thoughts. In the end, however, there is a feeling among even the closest of friends that it's either just plain time to get over it or at least not talk about it anymore. One acquaintance called and told me I had a year before I was to get on with my life. If I'd had a loud guffaw in me, I'd have delivered it to her. Another layer involved dealing with other people's discomfort at death. They do say the most ridiculous things to a griever. One colleague met me in a department store about 6 months after I'd lost Carl. She struggled with what to say and then finally burst out with, "I didn't send you a card." When I told her that it was all right, she then said, "But I like your son, so I think I'll send him a card." I said, "Well, I'm sure he'd enjoy that," and I turned and walked away. I'm sure she shudders to this day at that conversation. Another person, a nurse even, told me just weeks after Carl's death from a massive stroke that often the people who seem unconscious really aren't and that they know everything that is going on. That comment almost drove me over the edge. My daughter called several hours later and was able to talk me away from the turmoil that filled my head and heart at the thought of having condemned Carl to death while he lay and listened. I was near the middle of the rotten onion of awful realization, with many more layers to go, when it came to me that I would never get over Carl's death. I knew that I would be able to go on. I knew that I had people in my life who cared for me. But I would never get past the nearly 50 years of shared memories, nor did I want to. He is and was my inner geography, the person who knew me best. We were married so young that we often joked about having raised one another. Gratefully, I let him take care of spiders and leaky faucets and flooded basements. He was the one who often stayed home with our kids when they were sick, because I thought they were going to die and I couldn't stand it. Really, though, in most ways, we were a team. We could do chores together like a couple of dancers, each knowing his or her own parts and accomplishing the task at the end as if it were simple. We knew each other's every thought and most of each other's deepest worries. He could make me laugh like no one ever has. He had my back. I had his. That was another level of the rotten onion, the realization that I had no one in that position. When you've always been part of a team, the thought of being alone freezes you to the heart. I describe myself as feeling as if someone had hewn off my right side with a rusty axe and then had expected me to conduct myself normally. I also learned about solitude. I'd never really had much of that since I had left my parents and grandmother's arms to go to college, where I had two close roommates, and then I married Carl. We were constant companions, having chosen the same career where we enjoyed the same vacations and days of work. I learned this about solitude. I can do it, but I don't like it. On the other hand, I'm not the kind of person who can gain solace from so-called grief groups. It's just not in me to cry or divest myself of my true feelings in front of strangers, yet here I am doing just that to an anonymous group of listeners. There's no figuring it out, But there's honor in trying to gain perspective on such a life-altering event and then attempting to share that experience. It was at about that same time that it came to me that though I had thought I was a brave woman, I'd only been brave because of him. He supported me in everything. Of course I was brave. I had the Swedish Foreign Legion behind me. I knew I loved Carl from the day in high school where I was enduring another round of teasing by one of my classmates, much to the delight of some bystanders, when Carl rounded the corner. He picked up the tormentor and threw him down a flight of stairs where he became the butt of the joke as he lay at the bottom of the landing looking bewildered. Carl took my hand and we walked off together down the hall, and he had me from that moment on. Of course I was brave. In the end, when I neared the very core of Roar, I saw that loss is the price we pay for this wonderful life. And I've had a wonderful life. It continues to be good even without Carl because I knew and loved him and because he knew and loved me. That very fact has kept me from going adrift. It has let me venture out after a while like some scarred survivor, white and shaking, but still moving and still loving life. This is Pat Rosenleaf, who's 4 years out from the worst day of my life, and I guess I'm still standing.
Pat Rosenleaf is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Conrad Scheib.
And I'm Corin Cates Carney. Thank you for listening. And please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.